Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 196, Swimming and Sitting Under the Bodhi Tree.
Anyway, those who are in Bali, you already heard this because we discussed this. This is from the Flower Ornament Sutra. And in the Chinese, I have two texts today. A lot of you have the initiation text, which is good. And I have a translation that I and someone has been laboring on for like 20 years. Chapter 3 is the initiation chapter of the Root Tantra and the commentary by Pundarika, the White Lotus, who is an incarnation, one of the eighth king of Shambhala, and one of the incarnations of Avalokiteshvara. And actually, when I work on what he has to say, this commentator, the eighth king, he reminds me so much of His Holiness, actually. And because his incarnation of Avalokiteshvara too, you know. So I'm going to use this a little bit to help to give us a sense of connection to the original thing. But because yesterday we were here in Magadha, I just wanted to read this thing from the Flower Ornament. And those of you who were with us in Bali last spring, you will remember it. But since then, how many of you have ever seen the Flower Ornament Sutra, the English translation? Yes, you, and you were here. You were there in Bali too. Only you and Ekaterina.
I think
I've read it. And the Flower Ornament, according to the Chinese tradition, is records what the Buddha first did when he became a Buddha. In the exoteric Buddhism, or actually in Theravada Buddhism, non-Mahayana Buddhism, they think he remained in silence for 49 days, except for a conversation with Brahma. Brahma is like the head god in those days, who other people in India credited as the creator of the universe. So that's what the exoteric Buddhists and the dualistic Buddhists say. Those who think nirvana is somewhere else, you know. And Mahayana Buddhists say that during that time, the Buddha taught in various planes because there are 26 different heavenly planes in the Buddhist cosmology. And there are deities in all these different planes. And he taught in all of those different planes, and he was met by many, many celestial bodhisattvas who had power of interstellar travel by mind power. And they all assembled there, extraordinary sci-fi sort of thing that you have in the Mahayana Buddhism about the nature of the cosmos and the nature of some sort of higher developed beings. So the very first part, though, is describing what it was like under this tree at the time Buddha attained enlightenment, where we went. So I'm just going to read a little bit of that for you at the beginning of this amazing sutra. Thus did I hear on a certain occasion. Old sutras begin like that. The Buddha was in the land of Magadha, that's where we are now, Bihar, in a state of purity at the site of enlightenment that's sitting under the tree there, having just realized true awareness. You know, when you're in the bardo, that's another very interesting fact that must surprise you about, again, Buddhist cosmology. When you're in the bardo, there's only two things that you can't go through at will, you know, because you have a subtle body, so you can go through walls, go through the earth, go through mountains. There's nothing can obstruct you because you have this subtle subatomic body. And, but the two things you can't go through, you can't go through the ground here in Vajrasana, under the tree. The ground here is impenetrable. Somehow it's called the diamond ground, and no one can go through it. So here in this holy place, you're sort of at the most strongly connected place on the planet to the clear light of the void, to the sort of ultimate subtle nature of reality, they say. And the other place is your mother's womb. You can't go through the membrane of your mother's womb. So that bardo being ends up in the mother's womb, and if it's born in a mammal. You know, I guess eggshell if you're born in a chicken. May that not happen to any of us again. Since we've all been chickens in previous lives. So, at the sight of having just realized true awareness, the ground was solid and firm, made of diamond, adorned with exquisite jewel discs and myriad precious flowers, with pure, clear crystals. The ocean of characteristics of the various colors appeared over an infinite extent. They were banners of precious stones, constantly emitting shining light and producing beautiful sounds. That's what I said yesterday about in certain levels of beings who have a certain relation to the material. You can have like fabrics made of pure diamond, which doesn't mean diamonds tacked onto a cloth. It means diamond cloth. So the diamond is like a woven substance, constantly emitting shining light and producing beautiful sounds. Nets of myriad gems and garlands of exquisitely scented flowers hung all around. The finest jewels appeared spontaneously, raining inexhaustible quantities of gems and beautiful flowers all over the earth. There were rows of jewel trees, their branches and foliage lustrous and luxuriant. By the Buddha's spiritual power, he caused all the adornments of this enlightenment site to be reflected therein. The tree of enlightenment was tall and outstanding. Its trunk was diamond. Its main boughs were lapis lazuli, actually should be sapphire. I don't know, everybody does that, because they're transparent and lapis is not transparent. They translate this term lapis, which it isn't, it's sapphire. Its branches and twigs were of various precious elements. The leaves spreading in all directions provided shade like clouds. The precious blossoms were of various colors. The branching twigs spread out their shadows. Also the fruits were jewels containing a blazing radiance. They were together with the flowers in great arrays. The entire circumference of the tree emanated light. Within the light there rained the precious stones, and within each gem were enlightening heroes in great hosts like clouds simultaneously appearing. Tom Cleary, who translated this from Chinese, he translates Bodhisattva as enlightening hero, which is not a bad choice. Also, by virtue of the awesome spiritual power of the Buddha, the tree of enlightenment constantly gave forth sublime sounds, speaking various dharmas or teachings without end. The palace chamber in which the Buddha was situated was spacious and beautifully adorned. This is like a mandala chamber, in other words, a holographic jewel-created thing there in the tree, you know, at that time, you know. Was spacious and beautifully adorned. It extended throughout the 10 directions. It was made of jewels of various colors and was decorated with all kinds of precious flowers. The various adornments emanated lights like clouds. The masses of its reflections from within, of the reflections from within the palace formed banners. A boundless host of enlightening heroes, so I have boundless of pure light. A boundless host of enlightening heroes, the congregation at the site of enlightenment, all gathered there. By means of the ability to manifest the lights and inconceivable sounds of the Buddhas, they fashioned nets of the finest jewels from which came forth all realms of action of the spiritual powers of the Buddhas, and in which were reflected ages of the abodes of all beings. Also, by virtue of the aid of the spiritual power of the Buddha, they embraced the entire cosmos in a single thought. Their lion seats, that's like you're sitting in a lion seat. Lion seat just means a throne, you know, like a giant ornate royal throne with little lions in the front, carved in the front thing. So you're all sitting in such lion seats here in Bodh Gaya. That means you're in a place of great self-confidence, of connection to the ultimate reality of the power of enlightenment. Also, he always says, Tom always translates spiritual power, but it just means magical power, miraculous power, actually. It's nothing particularly spiritual about it. But he says that not to make it sound too, which I think it makes it sound more realistic. I don't know. Yeah. So the lion seats were high, wide, and beautiful. The bases were made of jewels. Their tableaus of lotus blossoms. Their seats of lotus blossoms. Their tableaus of pure, exquisite gemstones. They were adorned with various flowers of all colors. Their roofs, chambers, steps, and doors were adorned with the images of all things. The branches and fruits of jeweled trees surrounded them, arrayed at intervals. Clouds of radiance of jewels reflected each other. The Buddhas of if you look in any one of the gems, you see in each facet all the other gems interactive. So you see the holographic vision, like every subatomic particle contains every other one, you know, this type of vision. The Buddhas of the Ten Directions conjured regal pearls and the exquisite jewels in the top knots of all the enlightening heroes. They all had these kind of hairdos with jewels in the top knots. All emanated light, which came and illuminated them. Furthermore, sustained by the spiritual power of all Buddhas, they expounded the vast perspective of the enlightened ones, their subtle tones extending afar, there being no place they did not reach. At that time, the Buddha, the world-honored one in this setting, attained to supreme correct awareness of all things. His knowledge entered into all times with complete equanimity. His body filled all worlds, his voice all accorded with all lands in all directions. Like space, which contains all forms, he made no discrimination among all religious groups. And as space extends everywhere, he entered all lands with equanimity. His body ever sat omnipresent in all sites of enlightenment, in all planets, in all universes. Among the hosts of enlightening heroes, his awesome light shone clearly like the sun emerging, illumining the world. The ocean of myriad virtues which he practiced in all times was thoroughly pure, and he instantly demonstrated the production of all the Buddha lands, their boundless forms and spheres of light, extending throughout the entire cosmos equally and impartially. He expounded all teachings, all truths, like spreading great clouds. Each of his hair tips was able to contain all worlds without interference, in each manifesting immeasurable spiritual powers, teaching and civilizing all sentient beings. His body extended throughout the 10 sections, directions, yet without coming or going. His knowledge entered into all forms and realized the emptiness of things. All the miraculous displays of the Buddhas of past, present, and future were all seen in his light, and all the adornments of inconceivable aeons were revealed. And then it goes on like that. And then, you know, it names a huge host of bodhisattvas, of enlightening heroes, male and female enlightening bodhisattvas, Samantabhadra, etc. Samantabhadra means the holy good one. He's the sort of main bodhisattva of this sutra. And then there's a long passage describing all the members of beings in the assembly, all the gods, all the nagas, all the everything, a really huge assembly of people. And then this is just kind of cute. I like this. And then after that, it says, at that point, the Buddha, knowing what the enlightening heroes were thinking, emitted a multitude of light rays from his teeth. He's smiling, so the teeth then emit all these light rays. Those light rays were as numerous as atoms in a Buddha world, a Buddhaverse, atoms in a universe. They included, for example, light rays of flowers of jewels illumining everywhere, light rays producing various sounds adorning the universe, light rays draping subtle clouds, light rays showing the Buddhas of the Ten Directions sitting on their sites of enlightenment making mystical displays, light rays of umbrellas of clouds of flames of all jewels, light rays filling the universe without impediment, light rays adorning all Buddha fields, light rays setting up banners of pure diamonds, light rays adorning the scenes of enlightenment where hosts of enlightening heroes were assembling, light rays with subtle vibrations intoning the names and epithets of all the Buddhas. There are as many such light rays as there are atoms in a Buddhaverse, and each individual ray had as many light rays, again, accompanying it. Those lights all contained all exquisite jewel-like hues, and they each illumined oceans of worlds as numerous as atoms in a billion Buddha lands. The congregations of enlightening heroes in all the other oceans of worlds could see this lotus bank array ocean of worlds within those lights. That's the name of our, you know, galaxy, you know, ocean bank array. It means like a hedge with banks of flowers in it. There's a shape of the galaxies and within the nebula, let's say. By the spiritual power of the Buddhas, those lights, in the presence of all those enlightening heroes, intone these verses. Cultivating oceans of practices over countless aeons, making offerings to oceans of Buddhas everywhere, teaching and liberating the oceans of all beings, now fulfilling supreme enlightenment, the universal illuminator. From his pores come magic clouds, with light shining through all quarters, awakening those able to receive the teaching, causing them to approach enlightenment pure and unhindered. Buddha traversed all paths of existence, teaching and developing the living beings. The mystic powers at his command are infinite. Instantly he causes all to be freed. The enlightenment tree of precious gems is embellished with the finest ornaments. Buddhas truly awaken under it, emanating light, majestically shining. The roar of his great voice fills all quarters, preaching for all the way to great peace. According to the mental dispositions of beings, he wakes them by various means. He practices transcendent ways and fulfilled them. He practiced transcendent ways and fulfilled them. As many as atoms in a thousand lands, all the powers he has already attained, you all should go and pay him respect. Buddha children of all quarters, as many as atoms of lands, all come together with joy. Having showered clouds of offerings, now they stand before Buddha with single-minded gaze. One tone of the Buddha contains an infinity, able to expound the deep ocean of scriptures, raining the sublime teaching in accord with all minds. That most honored human you should all go see. The vows of Buddhas at all times are told under the enlightenment tree. All appear in an instant. Hurry to the Buddha's spot. Vairochana's great ocean of knowledge shines from his face. For all, Vairochana is the sort of cosmic Buddha who is Shakyamuni, same, but Shakyamuni becomes his emanation on this planet. But he's the same as Vairochana also, you know. Shines from his face for all to see. Vairochana means the shining one, you know. Now, awaiting the gathering of the masses, he's about to speak. Go see him and hear what he says. So I just wanted to read that. Because it's this sutra only exists in full in Tibetan and Chinese. But, you know, this is India, you know. If you can imagine a text like this being massively popular in a place like this. The text goes on in English translation for 1,600 pages. And there's, of course, many kind of teachings, like rational, logical teachings, but much of it is this visionary, you know, rains of flowers, of jewels, of light rays, of subatom, and blah, 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 it goes on like that. And, but all of its specific colors and textures, and it's extraordinary. And it just kind of, if you try to read it, I always tell people, if you read it, you swim in it. You don't really read in it, because your sort of ability to visualize is kind of crashes, you know, your graphics card doesn't have sufficient RAM, you know, and you can't visualize. But it's a vision of the world, you know, where like every atom contains every other atom, or subatomic particle, even, they say. And, you know, so the whole of the universe is in each atom in the universe, yet each one is unique in itself and in its place, is exactly what is needed to sustain the whole universe, you know. And so, and every moment of time is in every moment of time. So each of all, in one of the later sutras, you know, there's two-thirds of the sutra is the Buddha giving teachings with similar assemblies in the 26 different planes, the human plane and then other planes like this. And in each time, he radiates into the hells and the preta worlds and the animal realms, and he temporarily liberates beings there. And unfortunately, more beings head there by doing nasty things, by being confused. But, you know, he pumps them out, you know, and in this time, you know, everything is released kind of at this time. And then there's this last third is like a tale of a single human being, a yuppie, whose name is Sudana, which means good wealth and blissful wealth. And Sudana meets the Buddha in an assembly on earth, somewhere else in South India, actually. And he then gets inspired to go seek Kalyana Mitras, which means spiritual friends or virtue friends, you know, which is the role of teacher in most Buddhism is not a guru role, like an authority role. It's a friend role, because teacher is someone who is equal to you, actually. A good teacher is, not superior to you. The teacher, if they are enlightened, then they realize their equality with you, and they don't lord it over you. The good, sure sign of a bad teacher is someone who lords it over you and makes you feel like, oh, yes, Guruji, step on my head or whatever, you know. And not that a devoted student who becomes grateful of having learned something doesn't feel very humble, perhaps, and grateful to a teacher, but a good teacher does not take advantage of that. Because it just doesn't, a good teacher doesn't see it like that. A good teacher is the same as you and perceives themselves as the same as you. So their whole, what's good about life about them is when you get something out of it. And they feel really happy about that. And they don't sit there and feel better than someone else, actually. Supposedly. I mean, you know, maybe they want to, but they haven't managed. Because the reality is we're all completely interwoven with each other. So there's no way of being completely released from it without everybody being released. That's the key point. So that idea of the arhat, of the Theravada, that you can yourself become nirvana and leave people behind is wrong. And so Buddha didn't leave us behind. It's just that we don't know he took us with him. You understand? It's like that. And you know, that's finally kind of evocative language. So language ultimately is kind of evocative. Can evoke a sense of experience in yourself. It isn't like linear rational, although linear rational language has its place and it's very strong and very powerful in the Buddhist science teachings. But ultimate reality eludes any kind of linear description. Right? You got that. So anyway, the last one is the Sudana. And then he goes and sees 52 spiritual teachers, out of whom about 20-some are female. They're not all guys. And he meets, and when he gets more advanced, he meets, like, you know, beings who are timeless, like the Buddha's mother, Mayadevi, the Buddha's wife in the Buddha's life, the Buddha's, the goddess of Lumbini Garden, where he's born, the goddess of Magadha, of Hirabhadrasana, all kind of amazing beings he meets, and they all teach him different things. And that's called the Gandavyuha Sutta. And that does exist in Sanskrit still. And it has like one sentence, so it'll go for 6 pages in Sanskrit, all in compound. It's very difficult to translate or even read, but it's very, very powerfully evocative. But what I wanted to mention that for was that I started translating with the translator who translated that, Thomas Cleary, who's a great friend of mine. It was for a while. And he and I were reading it together, and we started at that Gandavyuha because it had a Sanskrit version, and we were comparing the late Chinese text and the Sanskrit text. And at the beginning of that, the Buddha turns into Vairochana. He turns blue, like medicine Buddha. Vairochana is a dark blue color. And he turned into Vairochana in assembly. And then a blue light radiated from his midbrow, where a Buddha has a little tuft of white hair. A perfect Buddha body has a little tuft of white hair, like a little transistor in the center, third eye space. Doesn't have 3 eyes, because he's human, but has this little tuft of white hair. And that radiates lights different moments when he teaches, like a special effect. And that light radiated in this vast host of beings. And those beings, all of them, instantly upon being touched by that light, remembered infinite previous lives. They became temporarily aware of all of their previous lives, like a Buddha, and all of their future lives, and they experienced themselves becoming Buddhas, and they experienced themselves being reborn in the womb of Queen Maya in a kingdom like that of, you know, whatever, maybe different names, and enacting the 12 Buddha deeds for the living beings in that universe, in many planets at a certain level at once, and et cetera, et cetera, and then attaining thorough nirvana, leaving the meat space, coarse body, and so on, et cetera, just like a Shakyamuni Buddha. And when I read it, I remember we were translating and I felt so annoyed. I think I was too much infected by being at Amherst College at the time, sort of Protestant ethic college. And I was thinking, how can they have that experience ahead of time? They didn't earn it. They didn't like work their way through 1,000 billion lifetimes of evolution. And now they're experiencing everything already in one split second. That's like, what do you mean? That's not fair. Like, I remember thinking, noticing myself thinking that. Which I was shocked at myself. So anyway, from the Buddhist, what it is it's a beautiful evocation in that sutra, which is not a tantra, not a tantra. It's not an initiation in a tantra. It's just a sutra, Mahayana non-dual sutra. But it's an evocation of the fact that the Buddha, when one person attains Buddhahood, in a way, everyone is touched at the deepest clear light level of their being, as we mentioned yesterday. And they're temporarily, therefore, become and can stably hold for at least a moment the same awareness as the Buddha. And the Buddha hasn't, in fact, abandoned them. He sees them in that perfection, so he's not abandoning them. But, and this is so interesting, at the same time, he sees they don't have the frame. They don't have the hardware, you know. They don't have the wetware, if you will, you know, the nervous system. They don't have the ability to embody such a vision. To them, it's overwhelming. They can't hold it. So it takes them a certain time to evolve their openness to such a place where they could be one with everything and perceive themselves as completely interfolded with every being, which must take quite some, you have to have some intensity of bliss and I don't know what, super, super wetware RAM, super imagination, realization, awareness, whatever you want to call it, to be of an infinite awareness, to have such an experience. You have to have something to embody that. So therefore, he also could see the exact time it would take different ones, because again, each one is unique, including this means like cockroaches and ants and mosquitoes and bacteria, if they're living beings, whatever it is. Each one has a certain time required to flourish. Like, you know, in a greenhouse, an expert gardener, horticulturist, knows this one will blossom in a week, in a month, and haven't seen, this one will take whatever, you know, and they don't go and like start tugging on the sprout to come up with the rose bush, because it would destroy it. It would overwhelm it. So then this is why Kalachakra is such an amazing vision granted by Buddha, also, in our view. It's actually my student who worked on this after I translated to her years and years ago. She says, catering to Western thinker. Yeah, in the 12th century, somebody wrote something, they made up the culture. Made me so depressed. I'm still writing that. You know, it's indivisible. The Tantrayana is indivisible from the realization of Buddhahood, because it is the art of enfolding other beings at a great higher rate. And if you had infinite energy and infinite awareness, but yet couldn't, but not omnipotence in the sense that you weren't the only energy and awareness in the universe, and you couldn't just take over everybody else's awareness and energy. They have their own. And only they can enjoy. So in that sense, Berzin, I was a little unfair to poor Alex Berzin yesterday. In that sense, Berzin is right. It isn't some soupy thing where we all become Carl Jung or something.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part episode was originally recorded during the Geographic Expedition and Tibet House U.S. member trip to Bodh Gaya, India, and to the Bodhi tree itself. As we heard in the first part of this teaching, Professor Thurman led a close live line translation of the Flower Ornament Sutra. This fantastical sutra is one of Professor Thurman's favorites to teach. If you're inspired by its imaginative description of the Buddha's enlightenment experience under the Bodhi tree, be sure to check out past episodes of the Bob Thurman Podcast labeled Flower Ornament Sutra. There's several from past Force for Good teachings, and there's an extended video on the Tibet House US YouTube channel. This free YouTube channel, like the Bob Thurman Podcast, is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including special invites to geographic expedition trips like the one we're listening to, be sure to visit tibethouse.us. The second half of this week's episode continues the teaching begun in the first half. In it, Professor Thurman continues his deep dive exploration of the Flower Ornament Sutra and the Buddha's enlightenment, and how they both connect to the teachings known as the Kali Chakra Tantra. The geographic expedition's trip that this was recorded at was to attend the Kali Chakra Empowerment by His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama. If you're inspired to learn more about these precious teachings, or you've attended a Kali Chakra Empowerment by His Holiness the Dalai Lama and have been hoping to deepen your study and practice of the Tantras, be sure to visit menla.us as Professor Thurman is leading 2 study and practice intensives on this exact subject. It's great for established Vajrayana Buddhists or those who have attended the empowerments in the past. In addition to this program for established Vajrayana practitioners, Professor Thurman will be leading several programs at Menla on the intersection of Buddhism and psychotherapy, the intersection of Buddhism and shamanism, and the intersection of Buddhist and yogic history. To learn more about these all-level programs, please visit Menla's website at menla.us. And as always, music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is provided by Tenzing Chogyal. Used with the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about Tenzing Chogyal, visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. And now, back to Bob and a reading of The Poetry of Mary Oliver by Gary Gock.
So we shouldn't conflate it with some soup-like thing, because that's what mystics do. Mystics do soup-like things, because mystics, and some of you may have had such experiences, where you just suddenly melt out there and you are everything. You are everyone. Or you have a space-like experience where you disappear at everyone and you feel that this is everything. And your disappeared state is the state of everything, and that's everyone's there with you in the disappearance. But actually nobody's there, and not even you are there. So it's the big oneness. I call it, some of you are used to me being rude like that, I call it the cheap oneness of the egotistical mystic who thinks I've achieved the one thing that we all are really, and so now I'm higher than anybody who hasn't achieved that, I think, because I think they haven't achieved it, so therefore I'm the guru of everybody or some kind of nonsense like that, just because I disappeared. Give me a break. It all disappeared last night. Conceivable thing is to be one with everything, with everybody else still there, and know exactly where they are, and then to know exactly what it will take them and how many lifetimes to reach wherever they feel thus exalted and free and completely blissful, and therefore like an endless, you know, vibrator of vibration of expanding that infinitely to an infinite world of beings, and as an infinite world of beings. And therefore to be, and since there's no way of controlling exactly what everyone will do, to be with them in the form of the emanation bodies of a Buddha, emanating forms and bodies and can be inanimate objects and planets. You know, if the Jedi warriors were Buddhas, when Obi-Wan felt a disturbance in the Force because the Death Star destroyed a planet of 7 billion beings, Obi-Wan and the Jedi would have, like, instead of just having a headache, they would have manifested another planet and caught every single soul of every being who'd lost their coarse body. And bam, they would have been right back there studying their ABCs or their kakagangas, which is that Sanskrit alphabet or whatever it is, right? In other words, produce a planet for them. Make manifest yourself as a planet. There's no obstacle to that. Still, you're not manifesting them because they are manifesting themselves. So you can't completely change their situation, but you can be there to be their optimal assistant sort of thing, if you follow me. Whatever it is they need, you know. You can be a work of art in front of them that opens their mind. You can be a parrot that sits there and say, "Oh, money, bring me home." You know, and you know what they need because you read their mind. And which must be quite an inconceivable thing to read everybody's mind simultaneously and be able to sort it out. And that inconceivable thing is manifested in the sort of highest art, the sort of highest salvific art of the Buddhist manifestation in the universe, which is the Kala Chakra, the machine of time. And there time becomes this wonderful thing. The time between someone like me, like some kind of, you know, preppy weirdo like me, moving from my meat space embodiment to becoming a perfect Buddha under this tree here, or in some planet or another, a tree like this, that time becomes, in a way itself, a manifestation of the Buddha's compassion. And so the Buddha shows a body that's made of time, in a mansion made of time, and turns all the divinities in the universe, with a sample 721 of them, into manifestations of time. And so this time becomes a positive thing, right? You know, time in most world religions is seen as a symbol of impermanence and therefore death and destruction, you know, such as the way Krishna shows himself in the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna, right, as the destroyer, you know, Mahakala, the great destroyer, you know, great time, because time is the destroyer, right? So here you have the enlightenment taking even the great destructive thing of impermanence and time and turning it into a nurturing, compassionate membrane in which we can nurture and grow. We, the Buddha embryos, you know. So time becomes a Buddha womb, just like space becomes a Buddha womb, in which we can grow into our own Buddhahood. It's kind of really magnificent, don't you think?
Yes.
I think so. I do love it. It's incredible. So somehow, 2,700 years, you know, the Buddhists think that Buddha lived much earlier, a few centuries earlier. There was a recent discovery in Lumbini, which is up on the border, what now is the Nepal border, of some things much more ancient in the temple to the Buddha's enlightenment than they had previously thought. Westerners are desperate to move Buddha more close to Jesus. They're really upset that Buddha's like many centuries earlier than Jesus, since his teaching really is very much similar. And of, you know, love and compassion part, especially. And even theistic part, actually. It's just that the abilities of the one deity are just differently assessed, let's say. You know, of any deity are differently assessed, but they perfectly like the deities, Buddha does. And the deities perfectly like the Buddha. And so, anyway, that this much later, you know, 2,700-800 years later, here we are back at the site. Around the site, there's this poverty and this all these difficulties and the dust, you know, that, you know, combustion engine, you know, like, you know, industrial plants, you know, creating pollution, etc., you know, on the planet where they're wrecking the whole planet with greed, consumerist greed, and threatening it with militarist greed. That's greed and hatred, two out of the three poisons, industrially magnified, you know. And yet, that supreme emanation of the Shakyamuni in his lifetime, where he manifested in South India as the Kala Chakra, the machine of time, the time wheel, is again being manifested at some subliminal level to the majority of those of us experiencing it, but somehow being touched by that inner deep subatomic, you know, energy is really something amazing. And the Kala Chakra body, you know, as I think I said yesterday, but the Kalachakra body and the Kalachakra teaching has one unique thing, which is called void body. So the Kalachakra manifests a void body. And that void body means that there's no atoms, no particles in the Kalachakra body. But, as I suggested to Deepak the other day, in his battle with the materialist scientists, it doesn't mean it's only a mind-made body, because at the plane of the clear light of the void, there's no difference between mind and matter. And so energy, and matter is just energy at that time. And the deepest level of energy has no particles. Particle is a kind of construct. You know, even a subatomic quark or boson or meson or Higgs boson, or whatever you want to call it.
The earth tremored. We all felt it here in San Francisco. And a few hours later, I learned that Mary Oliver had gone into the Bardo. She was, if you haven't heard, a Pulitzer laureate whose work is grounded in and grows out of a relationship between self and the world of owls, hummingbirds, egrets, ponds, the sun, and Walt Whitman, Thoreau, the Buddha, Mozart. The Buddha's last instruction. Make of yourself a light, said the Buddha before he died. I think of this every morning as the east begins to tear off its many clouds of darkness, to send up the first signal, a white fan streaked with pink and violet, even green. An old man, he lay down between two salad trees, and he might have said anything, knowing it was his final hour. The light burns upward. It thickens and settles over the fields. Around him, the villagers gathered and stretched forward to listen. Even before the sun itself hangs, disattached, in the blue air, I am touched everywhere by its ocean of yellow waves. No doubt he thought of everything that had happened in his difficult life. And then I feel the sun itself as it blazes over the hills like a million flowers on fire. Clearly I'm not needed. Yet I feel myself turning into something of inexplicable value. Slowly, beneath the branches, he raised his head. He looked into the faces of that frightened crowd. I'm Gary Gach, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.